Shop the Sherwin-Williams July Summer Sale and get 30% off paints and stains July 18th through the 28th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale is almost here. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair, plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping site-wide. Shop the sale at wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Karen Reed back in court again today, and we're going to take you right there for all of the coverage of what's going on in that courtroom and the follow-ups with Judge Beverly Cannone. Let's go there right now.
Dismissed for extraordinary governmental misconduct, a true and correct to the best of my knowledge, signed and sworn to under the pains and penalties of perjury this 21st day of February 2025. So, the fact, what you state is fact, that Lieutenant Fanning had control over and access to this jury is simply not true, Mr. Jackson. The only people who have any access to those jurors are the court officers in the Department of Security of the trial court in this courtroom. So, I am going to ask you what your good faith basis is for that, and I'd like you to start there.
If the court... if the court recalls the discussion at sidebar, we were told for the very first time, Your Honor, about this issue concerning the juror and concerning the individual who reported information suggesting that there was some sort of misconduct at sidebar by the court with no additional information.
No. I didn't tell you about the role. I didn't know who it was.
I'm getting to that. Because that was the next conversation that we had. When we were told on the day of closing argument to approach sidebar, the court indicated through multi-level hearsay, we'll all agree that it was some sort of multi-level hearsay suggestion that there was some sort of misconduct by the jurors. Or by a specific juror. We pressed the issue at sidebar and asked who the source was. At that time, for the first time, we were told the name Lieutenant Fanning. We obviously recognized
that. You were not told that by me.
No, we were told that by, and I'm getting to that as well. We were told that by Ms. McLaughlin. She's the one that indicated that it was reported. I'm sorry. That's not right. We pressed the issue on who was the source. I believe the court then inquired of one of the court officers.
In charge of the jury?
Your Honor, I'm getting to that. I understand that. But if you'll allow me to make the argument and to indicate what my declaration says, my good faith belief, based on a reasonable belief, this is how we get there. We were then asked, or the court asked the court officer to join us at sidebar. He then indicated that it was Lieutenant Fanning. Ms. McLaughlin then went on to say, and by the way, he indicated that Lieutenant Fanning had reported this, supposedly gotten it from some unnamed or unidentified person. There was no evidence presented at the time, as the court knows. There was no declaration. There was no report. There was no supporting documentation whatsoever. No recording, even though this report to the court through the court officer from Lieutenant Fanning indicated that this juror may be, quote unquote, may be on a recording. And the court confronted that juror with that information. There was a brief colloquy with the juror where she said, not that I remember, no. That was the initial statement that she said in terms of any misconduct. No, I wasn't talking about the case. Over the defense's objection, this very potentially defense-friendly juror was then excused. During that discussion at sidebar, that's when Ms. McLaughlin explained for the very first time to the defense that Lieutenant Fanning was in this circumstance. And she said that he was the, quote, commander of the extensive security operations that this case has required. Period. End quote. That sentence says a lot. It said a lot to
it
me.
It does not say he has access to or control over the jurors.
It says that
and
he has...
And I'm just going to stop you. I'll let you finish in a minute.
Okay.
Mr. Yannetti, as a Massachusetts practicing lawyer, knows that the court officers are in charge of the jurors. Go ahead, Mr. Jackson.
If there is a commander of the extensive security operations over the entire case, there is, Your Honor, no greater security operation than securing the jurors. That is sacrosanct. It's paramount among the security operations that the court embraces. And we were told, I didn't make it up, but Ms. McLaughlin told us. We were told he was the commander, not part of a security operation that was outside the court, not part of a security operation that helped parking cars or making sure that citizens got in and out of the courtroom appropriately. We were told he was the commander of the extensive security operations in this case. It is reasonable to conclude from that statement that Fanning was either directly in charge of the jurors, which the court is now telling me he wasn't. Again,
you were told that at sidebar that day by Ms. McLaughlin.
No, we were not. We were told.
I have the transcript.
Well, Your Honor, what we were told is what his title was. Commander of the extensive security operations of the court. So we reasonably concluded that he was either directly in charge of the jurors or in charge of the people who were in charge of security of the jurors. But we were never allowed the opportunity to find out exactly what his role was because the court didn't take evidence, refused our request at the time, in good faith. Both Mr. Yannetti and I asked the court to take evidence from Lieutenant Fanning. The court
I think it
declined.
Was Ms. Little.
I'm sorry?
I think it was Ms. Little who asked me to.
And what was the court's response? The court's response was to decline that invitation. We didn't take any evidence, which would have drawn down on the issue, so I wouldn't have to make reasonable conclusions. I would actually have the information. So, of course, that's one of the issues that is attendant to our motion to dismiss, because it seems wildly inappropriate. Here's what we do know about Lieutenant Fanning. Once his name was uttered, here's what we did know. He's among the troopers that is one of Michael Proctor's supervisors. He interviewed several prosecution witnesses who testified at trial against Ms. Reed, including Laura Sullivan, Marietta Sullivan, Bridget Meehan, Heather Maxson. He interviewed all of those individuals, or took part in those interviews. Lieutenant Fanning was at the defendant's home and seized her cell phone in January of 2024, just months before the trial began. Lieutenant Fanning was included on the text chain where Trooper Proctor said he was going through my client's phone looking for nudes. And then his name comes up at sidebar as the commander of the extensive security operations attendant to this case, and he's the source report to whom something was reported about juror misconduct. When you couple those two things together, that he's the commander of security and a person who supposedly, through hearsay, overheard a juror making statements about the case, and they have an entire myriad of individuals to whom they could report it. They report it to Fanning, and then Fanning reports it to the court officer who reports it to the court. It is not unreasonable to conclude that he was at least within the orbit of the security operations governing the jurors, which is exactly why we put it in our papers, and without additional information clarifying that, we have no way of knowing that he wasn't involved or didn't have any direct access to the jurors. If he didn't, he didn't. And that's a fact that everybody can agree on. But when we heard the information, the only reasonable conclusion we had, given the fact that he was the source of the information and he was defined as the commander of security over the entire case, not part of the case, the entire case, which includes the jury, that is a reasonable conclusion.
So you signed your affidavit 2 weeks ago when you already knew that he did not have any access to the jurors.
No, I didn't. I absolutely didn't.
Signed and sworn under the pains and penalties of perjury this 21st day of February 2025.
Correct. On February 21st, 2025, we were still at the first time that it was mentioned that he had absolutely no access to the jurors. He never had any contact with the jurors as when we received our responsive documents from the opposition from the Commonwealth. In that document, they mentioned He never had any direct access. He didn't have indirect access. They make these claims with no verification, by the way, no declaration, no supporting evidence, no declaration from the attorneys who filed the opposition. That's the first time someone actually took the position that he had absolutely no access to any of the jurors, direct or indirect. So when we filed our papers, the information that I just told the court is the information we were working from.
I will let you move on. I can tell you, I'm really not satisfied with your answer, Mr. Jackson.
Your Honor,
Well, put it this way. Let's say it this way. So, now that you know that he had absolutely no access to the jury, what's the nature of the conflict? How is your client's right to a fair trial jeopardized?
Is there evidence? My question to the court is there evidence that he had absolutely no access, either direct or indirect, with any of the jurors? I don't know that to be true. I mean, I take the court at its word, obviously. Clearly,
We'll move on from that, Mr. Jackson. So,
well, the court's asking what is our evidence of, or what's our indication of the impropriety of him being the person that actually reported this misconduct and ultimately leading to the exclusion of a very, very defense-friendly witness, I'm sorry, defense-friendly juror, or presumably a defense-friendly juror, and knowing at the same time that he was intimately involved in the prosecution of my client, that's the reason. Because he was at least within the orbit of commanding, according to Ms. McLaughlin, commanding the extensive security services over this case, and he ends up, just ironically, who knew, he ends up being the source of the information that got that juror removed. That's awfully coincidental, Your Honor. And yes, that's the foundation on which we built our argument that that shouldn't have happened. He certainly never, ever should have had any access, even in the orbit of the jurors, directly or indirectly, and the court never even inquired as to why he was the one receiving the report. Why Lieutenant Fanning, of all people, who then reports it to the court officer, who then reports it to the court, who then removes the juror? That's an awfully straight line between Lieutenant Fanning, who has an interest in this case, and the removal of a juror. That's improper, in our view. And that's why we put it in the papers, and that's why we argued it the way we did. Because we were working off of extremely reasonable beliefs based on information that was provided to us at sidebar in the court's presence.
All right, so that's your answer to my question.
That's my answer.
May I have a moment to confer with counsel?
Yes.
Thank you for that. The court invoked Mr. Unetti and said, as local counsel, he knows this not to be true. Mr. Unetti just indicated to me that that's not quite the fact. And so Mr. Unetti, I think, should be able to at least address the court. As the court said yesterday, when we file something, we file it on behalf of everyone, including Mr. Unetti. So if the court would allow Mr. Unetti to explain what his experience is, that may elucidate on this issue.
If we have time later, go on with your argument.
I'm happy to, Your Honor, and thank you for giving me the opportunity. The cumulative discovery misconduct by the Commonwealth, as laid out in our moving papers, through their agents, has been both egregious and pervasive. We've outlined most of these issues in our moving papers, all of these issues in our moving papers, but I want to concentrate my argument for the court this afternoon on the exculpatory Sally Port videos. I'm not waiving any of our arguments in the moving papers, but in the interest of time and focus, I think it's I think it bears upon the court at this point to consider most prominently the Sally Port issue, or the Sally Port video issue. The Commonwealth, to start off with, two facts that are true. The Commonwealth cannot deny the untimely disclosure of critical exculpatory evidence. They cannot and they will not deny that untimely disclosure. And they also cannot deny that critical evidence was intentionally, intentionally withheld from us. So what do they do in their opposition? Most of the time they spend saying that the prosecutors themselves did not know. They had no actual knowledge. While they concede the unavoidable in their moving papers, which is that the Massachusetts State Police and the Canton Police Department both knew about the evidence and both withheld it. Conveniently, they throw much of this on the back of Michael Proctor. It was sort of to be expected. He's already damaged goods, so why not? And they also bring in a newly revealed sergeant, a sergeant by the name of D.G. Impetro, who's already retired, gone from the police force, and who interestingly retired just 2 days after the Commonwealth's October 2024 disclosure revealing previously withheld Sallyport video.
I'm just going to ask, is he available, Mr. Brennan?
Not today, but he could be available.
No. I'm just curious, so he's still around?
He is, okay. Yes, and he's cooperative.
All right, Mr. Jackson, go ahead.
Our motion illustrates that, and by the way, I'll walk through the videos that we did get and when we received them. Our motion illustrates that dismissal in this case is required because of the cumulative impact of clear-cut discovery violations, clear-cut inexcusable Brady violations. And from a legal standpoint, the conduct in this case is so egregious, it's so pervasive, and it's so deliberate that prejudice must be presumed. We don't have to prove prejudice. It should be presumed. To begin, I want to start the issue by talking about the condition of Ms. Reed's passenger taillight. The condition of that SUV passenger taillight at the time it was brought into the Sallyport at Canton PD is of critical importance, and that may be one of the most important facts in this entire case. It's important because we know as a fact now that not a single piece of taillight was ever recovered at 34 Fairview until after that vehicle was in the possession of Michael Proctor and the Massachusetts State Police. That is the foundation on which this entire argument is built, and it is an undisputed fact, although it wasn't undisputed for years. Other material facts that are not in dispute. The Sallyport video has been in the possession and custody and control of the Commonwealth since January 29th, 2022. That is a fact. It's also a fact that none of it, not one bit of it, was ever disclosed to the defense until April 4th, 2024. On April 4th, and I want to walk through what videos we did get and when. On April 4th, we got two videos. One was the Sallyport interior front wall. That was the video that was missing 42 minutes, which was the 42 minutes where it would have shown the car being pulled into the Sallyport. And we also received a Canton Police Department driveway video with the SUV on the flatbed, which did not show the rear end of the car. On April 23rd, 2024, and by the way, April 4th, the court will recall, was just in the shadow of the beginning of the trial. On April 23rd, in the middle of the trial, we received another Sallyport interior back wall video. That was the video that is now sort of famously inverted. On October 10th, 2024, 2 days before Sergeant D.G. Impetro retired, we received four videos. The Canton PD interior hallway, the Canton PD rear lot main side, the Canton PD rear lot cruiser side, and the Canton PD church side exterior Sallyport. And I highlight the word exterior because it becomes extremely important in just a moment. These are four videos, all of which show Brian Higgins in some way, shape, form, or fashion at the Canton Police Department on January 29th, 2022. Then on January 28th, 2025, the Canton Police Department main driveway side exterior Sallyport was given to us. It's a grainy and very wobbly video that nobody can sort of make heads or tails out of. You can see the general outline of a vehicle, but the condition or the quality is so bad that you can't tell what the condition of the taillight is, which is what we're interested in. And I bring this to the court's attention, or I highlight this, because this is the second exterior Sallyport video that we ever received. One on October 10th, one on January 28th, 2025. Then on Friday, this past Friday, something pretty remarkable happened. We just received a report from Sergeant Buchnick dated February 28th, which is 4 days ago, 5 days ago now. And he makes an important admission in that report for the very first time during all of this. He indicates that in May of 2024, during trial, he was, quote, provided with a thumb drive and the CD labeled with a post-it note on my desk to review prior to testimony. He goes on to say, quote, at this time, I reviewed the video and made available to me, which included video footage of the Canton PD exterior Sallyport. Exterior Sallyport. That means that the Massachusetts State Police not only had in their possession exterior Sallyport video, but they knew about it and were reviewing it during trial. But we didn't get any of it until, as I just said, October 10th, we got one. January 28th of this year, we got the other. So that was withheld from us for the entirety of the first trial and all the way until at least October 10th, possibly as late as January 2025, and they've now admitted that. But who else knew about this withheld video in May of 2024 during trial? On cross-examination...
So can I just ask, was this of better quality than anything you had had, or was it the same wobbly?
Same. Okay. Same. Wobbly, grainy, can't make heads or tails out of hardly any of it. No. The question is, who else knew about this? Did anybody else know about this being withheld from us in May of 2024 during trial? On cross-examination on June 6th, Trooper Buchnick admitted to reviewing video evidence with Mr. Lally in May of 2024 in prep for his testimony. Was that the video that they were reviewing together? Was it the exterior Sallyport video? We now know that Buchnick watched some sort of exterior Sallyport video. He admits it in this report that we just got 5 days ago. And we also know that he and Mr. Lally were reviewing video together before his testimony in May of 2024, as he admitted to that on cross-examination during trial. But I didn't have information about what he was reviewing because we didn't have the videos. So either they reviewed together the inverted video that was then played and knowingly presented false evidence to a jury and to this court, or they reviewed exterior Sallyport video and intentionally withheld it from us. This is binary. It could only happen one of two ways. Either it was the inverted video that they prepped on and then presented inverted video to the jury, which is a problem, or they reviewed external or exterior video and did not provide it to us intentionally. Either way, the withholding that evidence admitted to now by Trooper Buchnick was obviously egregious. It was obviously in error. It was obviously calculated. Another important material fact not in dispute, on April 10th, 2024, the DA certified disclosure of, quote, all evidence.
Can I just get back to that, what you were just discussing about May 2023?
Yes.
How is that exculpatory?
Because the videos themselves, as the court will see through the presentation of my oral argument, that the fact that those videos all just happened to either be grainy, wobbly, missing 42 minutes, or from the wrong angle and flipped backward, all tend to show that the Commonwealth doesn't want the condition of the taillight to be seen by anybody when it's pulled into the Sallyport. That is a reasonable inference. In other words, okay, it's the cumulative effect of the bad videos that helps us. That's why it's exculpatory.
All right. And also, could you explain to me the prejudice?
I will get to the prejudice as I move through.
Now or no? If you're going to do it later, that's fine.
I will do it later. I think the prejudice is cumulative. Obviously, we didn't have the information that we needed to be able to cross-examine the witnesses that we needed to be able to cross-examine at the time that it was provided.
Okay.
It just, very obviously, there were certain videos that were clear from some cameras on other days and other times, but these cameras that were late discovery that was provided to us just so happened to all go out. They all find their way to be defective in one way or another at the exact moment that we would need them. On April 10th, 2024, the DA filed its certification of giving us all evidence that they had in their possession. and that they had done a reasonable inquiry. Both of these, that certification was just flat not true. How could that be true, and we're still getting video evidence that is in their possession, custody, and control in October, in January? How could that possibly be true? It isn't true. And it's illuminating when you look closely at the Commonwealth's opposition to our motion. First and notably, the Commonwealth makes these broad statements couched as fact. They're bold pronouncements, and there's myriad excuses in their opposition paperwork. And it's backed up by next to nothing. Not a single exhibit at the time they filed their opposition. There's some exhibits that have been lately provided, including some exhibits just a few minutes ago that they're now adding to their exhibit list and to their opposition. But in point of fact, at the time they filed their opposition, there was no factual support for any of its positions.
So are you pointing me to something specific, or are you just saying in general and you'll wrap it up?
In general, the only thing that they had attended to their opposition was this joint affidavit that doesn't address any of the defense allegations at all. Contrast that with the defense motion, which was supported by nearly 20 fact exhibits. There may be a reason why they didn't support their positions with exhibits at the time. It's because the facts don't support the Commonwealth's position. These are indefensible and indisputable facts that I'm explaining to the court about the turning over of these Sallyport videos. Specifically, turning to the Canton PD surveillance video, the opposition says, or reads, the Commonwealth provided the defense with a...
I just always like to read along. Where does it say it?
I don't have the page number.
Okay.
It's the point at which the Commonwealth indicates that they provided 90 photographs.
Okay.
Crime scene photographs. In support of the vehicle in the Sallyport. That is a distraction. What they don't mention in their moving papers is that the date of those photos were all February 1st, 2022. There are no photographs from January 29th, 2022, when the vehicle was brought into the Sallyport. The only thing we would have would be the videos, the surveillance videos, all of which are somehow some way defective and which were held in their possession in some instances for nearly 3 years before it was turned over to us. So it's the condition of the car at the time that it was brought into the Sallyport on January 29th at around 5:30 p.m. that matters. That's the only time that it matters. The other evidence referenced by the Commonwealth about a 5 a.m. ring video and Canton police cruiser at 8 a.m. and the independent observations of Dighton police officer Sergeant Barros, they all corroborate the defendant's contention that the taillight was cracked and not shattered at the time it was brought in to the Sallyport. And we're still talking about the condition of the taillight, obviously, when it was brought into the Sallyport. The Commonwealth next mentions that Lieutenant O'Hara from the CERT team arrives at 32 Fairview Road at 4:56 p.m. They then go on to mention that he was preceded by another trooper at 4:54 p.m. and that the car got to the Sallyport at 5:30, suggesting, obviously, that the search began and taillight pieces were found before the car ever arrived. That would be interesting if it were true, but it's not true. It's a distortion of the truth. It doesn't matter when the CERT team actually arrived and drove up there and sat in their warm cars and waited for other team members. The last team member to arrive didn't arrive until 5:41, 11 minutes, long after the car had already been secured in the Sallyport, long after Trooper Michael Proctor had access to that passenger taillight. The first taillight piece was not seen or found or recovered until 5:45 p.m. after the vehicle's arrival at Canton PD. That was seen. We can see who's got access to the vehicle and who makes access to the vehicle in that inverted video. Once we turn it back around, it's very obvious. That's Michael Proctor milling about at the passenger taillight. These are important details to get right. The timing matters. The opposition claims that the defense theory is quote-unquote evolving. They write that the defense, quote, struggles to establish how the condition of the defendant's broken taillight in Canton, in the Canton PD Sallyport, is in fact exculpatory. How is that exculpatory? the condition of the taillight, that it was cracked and not shattered as it moved into the sally port, how do we struggle to describe that as exculpatory? Of course it's exculpatory. Of course having those videos withheld from us is prejudicial. There is no struggle. It's on the video, it's on the Ring video that establishes that the right rear Lexus hit the back of the Chevy Traverse, cracking its taillight. The Commonwealth, pretty desperate to ignore that inconvenient fact or that inconvenient piece of video evidence, literally previously said in open court that the Lexus only got close to the Traverse, only to be completely impeached when everybody in the courtroom at trial saw that 5,000-pound Traverse jostle, its rear wheel jostle, under the impact of the SUV right at the right rear or the passenger side taillight. Now the Commonwealth, with no factual support, no factual underpinnings whatsoever, says, okay, hang on a second. It did hit it, but it didn't crack the taillight. So whose theory is evolving? Ours or the Commonwealth's? The defense has never wavered. We knew that Michael Proctor, from the very beginning of this case, had been lying about the time he first took possession of that SUV. He claimed that it was at 5:30. The court will recall this. We had litigation concerning this. He wrote it in at least 9 reports that we were able to count. 9 reports or affidavits. Those affidavits sworn under oath, and the Commonwealth repeated that time for nearly 2 years, even going so far as to argue to this court that the defense got it wrong, that we were wrong because we failed to calculate for daylight savings time. So the Commonwealth battled us, and this is something I think the court has to really weigh and balance, the following conduct. The Commonwealth battled us for nearly 2 years on the singular issue of the time that the SUV got to the sally port. They finally took their medicine at some point and had to admit to the false time and chalked it up to a Scrivener's error in 9 separate documents, memorialized 9 separate times, some of them under oath. And all the while they were battling us on the time that it got there, the defense is all wet, they're wrong, they just didn't account for daylight savings time. Oh, no, this was just a little mistake, it's not a big deal, it was a Scrivener's error. And the entire time they're making both of these claims, they had video in their possession that established unequivocally that that car was in Michael Proctor's possession at 5:30 and pulled into the sally port at 5:30. They knew the time. They knew that he had retrieved it at 4:12 in the afternoon and not gotten it to the sally port until 5:30. So the Commonwealth was well aware in 2022. The Commonwealth and their agents were well aware in 2022 that the SUV got to the sally port, and that was the centerpiece of the defense case. They knew that the videos would directly impeach the lead investigator on this case, and they say that we struggle to explain the exculpatory nature of this evidence. It's not our struggle to explain it. It's their struggle to acknowledge it. Of course that's exculpatory. It directly and unequivocally impeaches their lead investigator on one of the most important issues in the entire case. And that's only one aspect of the withheld videos that also is exculpatory. The other is the point at which it would show the condition of the taillight. In other words, when it's being pulled in to the sally port, would it show the condition of the taillight before Trooper Proctor had access to it in the sally port? That's what we've been seeking. The Commonwealth is well known from the beginning of this case that the defense has demanded all physical evidence be preserved. That is, this is not a game of Wordle. This is not something that's supposed to be parsed. All physical evidence be preserved. That's pretty straightforward. The Commonwealth shouldn't be in the business of withholding exculpatory evidence by playing some sort of a gotcha game with definitions of words. They knew what we meant. We don't actually know what the Commonwealth has, so we have to be as broad as we possibly can when asking for evidence to be preserved. So all physical evidence clearly includes the entirety of all the sally port videos. The Commonwealth parses words by saying, well, we never asked for the Commonwealth to preserve the CPD footage from the Sallyport because the Canton PD is not the crime scene. You asked for crime scene footage, and Canton PD is not the crime scene. Well, first, I think that's a disingenuous argument that plays right into that sort of gotcha that we've discussed. I think the Commonwealth is better than that. That's not what we should be doing in a trial for murder. And second, let's not forget that District Attorney Morrissey actually defended publicly Michael Proctor by explaining that when he said, Michael Proctor said, he responded to the crime scene, and of course we knew he didn't respond to 34 Fairview, D.A. Morrissey said, oh, he was talking about Canton PD, which is the crime scene. So they can't have it both ways. They write on page 4 of their opposition, quote, the trial prosecutor was not aware of the existence of surveillance video in the Canton Police Department's Sallyport until receiving the federal grand jury transcript of Massachusetts State Trooper Michael Proctor, end quote. So they've taken the position, look, we personally did not know anything about that Sallyport video existing until we received the federal grand jury paperwork showing that Michael Proctor testified to it. First, the Commonwealth has to know that that is not the state of the law in Massachusetts. Massachusetts State Police and Canton Police Department are both arms of the prosecution actively involved in the investigation of this case. Not one, but two separate agencies not only knew of the existence of the footage, but the lead investigator actually admitted to a federal grand jury that he pulled the footage at the start of the case. He pulled it all. And then he said he reviewed it all because that's what the case agent does. The Commonwealth cannot absolve themselves of the egregious and very obviously intentional discovery violations by Michael Proctor, by the Massachusetts State Police, by the Canton Police Department, by saying, I personally didn't know about it. The cases are legion on that issue. Commonwealth versus Sleeper, 2002 case found at 435 Mass 581, and this is Hornbook law, quote, a prosecutor's duty to disclose exculpatory information or exculpatory evidence extends to evidence in the possession of the police who participated in that investigation. And then Massachusetts Rule of Criminal Procedure 14A1A, the prosecutor shall disclose information covered by mandatory discovery, provided it is in the possession, custody, or control of the prosecutor. Persons under the prosecutor's direction or control, or persons who have participated in investigating or evaluating the case and either regularly report to the prosecutor's office or have done so in this case. Michael Proctor worked out of the Norfolk DA's office, physical plant. There is no question that Michael Proctor and both agencies intentionally withheld that evidence. Let's talk about Michael Proctor's testimony before that grand jury. He was asked the following question. Are you aware whether there are any cameras in the garage or Sallyport where Karen Reed's SUV was parked? Answer, yes. Question, have you reviewed the footage of that garage? Answer, I saw one very grainy video and then another of Sergeant Buchnick and I arriving in the main entrance around 5:30 following the vehicle. Question, when did you watch the video from the Sallyport? Answer, I haven't reviewed it, sir, in quite some time.
So do you have those page numbers for me?
I can get them for you, Your Honor. Okay. I didn't cite them in my notes.
Yeah, if Ms. Little can get them for you before you finish, that would be helpful for my review.
I haven't reviewed it, sir, in quite some time, so I can't recall what's on there. Question, why did you review video of the Sallyport? Answer, we review every video we pull. We pull a lot of video. It's on the case officer to watch it. By his own admission, Your Honor, Michael Proctor recognized himself in a video along with Sergeant Buchnick. That was likely the video that ended up being inverted by where Michael Proctor was by the passenger side taillight. And that was before any taillight material was ever recovered at 34 Fairview. That is highly inculpatory of Michael Proctor. It is highly exculpatory of Karen Reed. Another point of fact. By his statement, Michael Proctor admitted that, quote, we pulled, end quote, the video. That video is on a 30-day overwrite. The Michael Proctor testimony in front of the federal grand jury is at page 79, lines 1 through 13.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Little.
Exhibit C, is it Charlie?
Okay.
The video is on a 30-day overwrite, Your Honor. We all now know that. We didn't know that before just a few weeks ago. I don't expect that the Commonwealth knew that either. This is new to everybody, right? But you have to have pulled the video within the first 30 days to even be able to review it. We've been getting these videos in dribs and drabs for not months, but for years. Actually, it's been months. Hasn't been years. He further admitted that it shows the SUV arriving in the Sally Port at 5:30, which means he wrote those reports and signed those affidavits, the nine that I was talking about earlier, with full knowledge that there existed a video that he had and had reviewed that proved he was lying. It doesn't get any more exculpatory than that. And that was the video, that was the very video that was withheld from us, from the defense, for 2.5 years until the middle of trial. The Commonwealth says the, quote, trial prosecutor, end quote, was not aware. It's becoming a relatively common refrain in the opposition. That's neither a defense nor a justification for blatant and egregious discovery violations by the Commonwealth and its agents. The fact that the trial prosecutor, whoever that is, it's an interesting use of a name, of a pronoun. I don't know who the trial prosecutor is, but apparently the trial prosecutor, according to the Commonwealth, didn't know anything about this. But that's not a defense. Who is the trial prosecutor? Is it Adam Lally? Is it Laura McLaughlin? Is it both of them? And why are they only referring to one trial prosecutor when there were clearly two in the courtroom? They make the statement with no factual support for that anywhere. Again, the only affidavit that was supplied was a type of affidavit I've never seen before, where it's signed under oath by three different people. So which sentence goes with which person under oath? The single declaration is odd, to say the least, but it certainly doesn't define who's responsible for what statement in that declaration. We certainly know that it was not Hank Brennan. He was not involved in the first trial, so it can't be him. The Commonwealth writes, quote, the prosecutor had not been alerted to his existence, to its existence by investigating officers, end quote, but claimed that on April 4th, they promptly presented the defendant with nine surveillance videos in its possession. The Commonwealth received the federal materials.
Were those all from the Canton Police Station?
I'm sorry?
Were those all from the Canton Police Station, those nine videos?
My understanding is those were from the Canton surveillance. They're talking about the Canton. I didn't go back and audit which nine they're talking about because I thought we only received eight, but I believe they're all from the Canton.
Ms. Little, were they all from the Canton Police Department?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The prosecutor had not been alerted to its existence by investigating officers, but on April 4th, they promptly presented it to the defense. The Commonwealth actually received the materials that highlighted the fact that these existed in February of 2024, probably around February 21st, 2024, because that's when both sides got all the federal materials. That is not prompt. We presume that Mr. Lally has daily communications or had daily communications with Michael Proctor as the investigator, the lead investigator on the biggest case that the Commonwealth, this office of the Commonwealth has seen in a long time, and it took 2 months to produce an incomplete production of these videos. We didn't even get all of them at the time. The Commonwealth writes, quote, the quality of the video is poor in certain portions. However, this is the condition it was recorded in. Says who? That's a fact question, one that needs to be answered. And it's an important question. Who says that the Commonwealth received these, or I'm sorry, who says that this is the condition that those videos were recorded in? We've got no facts to support that whatsoever. And then the Commonwealth goes on and says, and that was the condition in which it was received by the prosecutor. That's also a fact question that needs to be answered. And these questions could be answered with a proper evidentiary hearing. The Commonwealth's representations about Louis Jutras, the technology director for Canton, being subject to cross-examination about the Canton PD video surveillance system is also just not true. They indicate, well, we had access to Louis Jutras and could have cross-examined him on all of these issues. Louis Jutras was called for a very specific reason, the town library video. We had no way of knowing at that time that he had any connection whatsoever with the Canton Police video system. We were not told that until well after trial. That was never disclosed to us, and I think Mr. Brennan used this phrase not long ago, that would have been nice to know of Mr. Louis Jutras. The first time Louis Jutras was ever disclosed as the person who installed the cameras at Canton PD was in a report dated October 10th, 2024. According to Colleen Crawford, and the court's heard her name as well, one of the Commonwealth's experts, Jutras indicated that he replaced and disposed of the camera capturing the inverted video at some unidentified point between January 29, 2022, when the inverted video was actually taken, and July of 2024, because it was quote-unquote defective. Interestingly, that's the only video that's clear. It's inverted, but at least it was clear. And that's the camera that, according to the Commonwealth, was replaced as defective. A week after filing its certificate of compliance, after the defense brought to the court's attention that 42 minutes was missing from the Sallyport video that we did receive, lo and behold, the Commonwealth produces a new video that also purports to show the passenger side taillight, except, as the court now knows, that's the one that was inverted. In the moving papers, in its opposition papers, the prosecution says, well, the prosecution had not previously received this video or knew of its existence. This is now the third or fourth time the Commonwealth sort of runs to this argument, I didn't know. We did not know about its existence. No matter how many times they write it, however, it does not change the Commonwealth's responsibilities. It doesn't change the prejudice that the defense suffered. We should have had these videos at the very beginning.
So, Mr. Jackson, I'm just going to ask you how much longer, this is the luncheon recess, but how much longer are you going to be?
Probably 45 minutes, I would say.
All right, so we'll break.
What? Memorize this? Was back in session, you may be seated.
All right, Mr. Jackson, go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Your Honor. When we left off before lunch, we were discussing the inverted video. In the moving papers, the prosecution indicates that, quote, the prosecutor had not previously received this video or knew of its existence. This is the third or the fourth time that the Commonwealth sort of runs to this argument about not knowing personally about the existence of a particular video, but that it doesn't matter how many times they argue that point, it still doesn't change the fact that it prejudiced the defense by not having it, and one of their members, whoever that agent is of the Commonwealth, was lying about having it and not disclosing it. Somebody knew, and the question before the court is, who was it? Who did know? Perhaps it wasn't Mr. Lally. Perhaps it wasn't Ms. McLaughlin. Was it Chief Rafferty? Certainly Proctor had it. He watched it. Who else knew about it? Members of the prosecution knew of the existence of this and other videos, and they hid them. And that's the galling issue. Then the Commonwealth writes that the defense altered, their word, the defense, quote, altered evidence to correct the image, as if we were altering something to deceive the court. When in point of fact, the Commonwealth well knows that that altered video was altered by them in some way, shape, form, or fashion. When it was played inverted. What we did is re-correct it to the proper orientation to confront Sergeant Buchnick with it. They indicate that they played the entirety of the video, of the corrected video, to somehow suggest that the Commonwealth, during this debacle, had clean hands. And that's just not true. Over the course of 2 days, the court will recall, 2 days worth of testimony, day one with Sergeant Butnick under direct examination by Mr. Lally, going into the next day, still under direct examination by Mr. Lally, they played that video completely inverted. They talked about it, they discussed it, they described it. Not once did Sergeant Butnick or Mr. Lally inform the jurors or the court that the video was actually altered, that the video was actually backward, not one hint to the court or the jury members. When the defense stood up and began questioning Sergeant Butnick about that video, that was the first time that he admitted that it was inverted. He used the phrase a mirror image, and that he knew that it was inverted. Amazingly, that was the same time that Sergeant Butnick started having trouble with his memory about who was actually depicted in that video. The court will recall before I stood up on cross-examination, under direct examination by Mr. Lally, Sergeant Butnick was very quick to point out that the individuals on that inverted video were himself and Michael Proctor. And they made the point that Michael Proctor never approached or had any access to or didn't manipulate in some way, shape, form, or fashion. This was the intimation by the Commonwealth, that passenger taillight. The Commonwealth has now conceded that that person was, in fact, Michael Proctor. It's notable that the Commonwealth went to great lengths to state that, quote, Trooper Proctor, and this is in their opposition, Trooper Proctor is standing feet away from the defendant's vehicle and never touched the right rear taillight, end quote. That's a statement made in their moving papers, specifically on a fact that is of great material importance to this case. The three prosecutors signed an oath and a declaration, and the court just called the defense out on signing a declaration or an oath. And the court's intimation, at least, in its initial comments to me was...
And that is the latest from the courtroom and the hearing of Karen Reed today. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations about this case, the hearings, and more. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.